Okay, we are in Ezra Perek Vav, chapter 6. And oh, do we have mysteries to deal with today? We are in the story that began with chapter 5, in which Tadnai, the governor, perhaps goaded by Samaritans, perhaps not, as we've already discussed, decided that he was going to challenge the Jews' right to build this temple that they're building. He says, you don't have the proper documentation or the proper paperwork. The response from the Jews is to show him, we have the vessels of the temple, and we were licensed, and we even had the pacha as part of our group. But no, we actually don't have the document itself. And Tatnai, somewhat startlingly, says, that's okay, you can keep on building. I'm just going to send back to headquarters to find out what actually is going on here and whether you're licensed to build. The text actually said it was from God that they were permitted to continue to build. And we explain that in two different ways. Either that Tatnai is an enemy, but that God influences him to let him build, to let the Jews build, or alternatively, that the element that is from God is the fact that it's Tatnai who's only interested in this from the governance perspective, who stops them, as opposed to the Samaritans. Had it been the Samaritans, there's no way the Jews could have continued. But Tatnai is not particularly against us. He just wants to make sure that all the paperwork is filled out and that nobody's going to get in trouble. So the message goes back to Persia, and they investigate, and instead of finding the document in Babel, in the capital city in Babylon, they actually find it instead in Madayan Media, as we talked about last time. Possible suggestion that this is how it evaded Haman's notice. We noted from Malbim, and in the document that they find, there is indeed a record of the license of the Jews to build the second base Hamikdash. And not only that, we find elements there that didn't appear in Perek Aleph, that didn't appear in the story as it showed up in chapter 1. Right? Specifically, if you take a look at chapter 6, sentences 3 to 5, that's where the text shows up. We're told that the Jews are going to be entitled to build. We get the dimensions of the building. And we're also told about building the walls with layers of wood and stone. We'll talk about that more today. We're told that the expenses are going to be paid by the palace. And we are told that the vessels should be given to the Jews. That's all the original record, which did not show up in the record that was in chapter 1. And then we also saw, and this was most remarkable, that in addition to the initial approval of Cyrus, Darius says, I'm going to go even further. And so he told us in chapter 6, sentence 6, if you're working with the Stone Tanakh, you want to be at the bottom of page 1825. No, I'm sorry, you want to be on page 1820. No, the bottom of page 1825. That actually is correct. Yes. Darius, in addition to Cyrus's license to build and saying that the palace is going to provide, Darius says to them, leave the Jews alone, let them build, and I would like you to provide from the local tax collection. So the money is local, it doesn't have to come from headquarters, but from the local tax collection, I want you to make sure to fund their karbanos, to fund their offerings, whatever those offerings are, and we're going to break down the verses in a little bit. All of that should be provided, whatever the Kohanim say that they need, without fail. Let them bring their offerings and let them pray on behalf of the life of the king and his children. That's Darius's addition to the... and there's more actually coming. There's a penalty for people who get involved in obstructing the construction. Darius is very much on their side. So that's what I want to open up with. We talked about this a little bit at the end last time. But it really requires some explanation. Why is Darius so on fire to help the Jews? I mean, what Cyrus did was remarkable. But could be understood in the guise of realpolitik, right? We show that Cyrus did this for the Babylonians also. Rather than have to dominate people and be constantly concerned that they are unhappy and that they want to rebel and that they're going to fight against me and so on, let me get them on my side by saying that their God has selected me as their savior. I am going to allow them to build their temple, and I'll even bankroll it a little bit and make everybody happy. That part we understood. In addition to which, of course, we had the additional motivation for Cyrus that his name happens to appear in Yeshaya, in the book of Isaiah, and taking the view that he is familiar with this, that's another nice another nice incentive for him to cooperate. But whoa, Darius has gone way past what Cyrus said. Darius has said, I'm going to fund the offerings, the sacrifices themselves. That's not cheap. I'm going to fund that from my own palace. And not only that, if anybody stops them from building, there's going to be a severe penalty against them for doing so. What in the world so excites Darius such that he feels like this has to go forward? So what would you say?
His mom.
So one approach is that this is a religious motivation. This could very well be what motivates the Midrashim that say that Darius' identity is son of Achashverosh and Esther. That he is actually their offspring. The weakness in that is then why didn't he initiate this himself? Why does it wait until a letter goes back from Tatnai saying, should these Jews be allowed to build? If Darius is doing this because he's wearing a chai necklace and he went to Jewish summer camp, then I want to know why it is that it only showed up once Tatnai challenged what the Jews were doing. But yeah, I think that could be the driver behind those midrashim.
It could be because he's caught in the middle. He's got Esther on one side, but the cubit of it, he's got Dan on the other, and he's no angel.
Right, it could be. It's sort of the Esther versus Achashverosh influence. By the time he becomes king, though, Achashverosh is gone. Right, that's usually the way it works in the Middle East. When it doesn't, you have big problems. Debbie, what were you going to say?
Well, I said this last week. When people generally are good to the Jews as a group, non-Jews are good to the Jews as a group. It's generally because it's a benefit to them.
Right.
My mom these days, blah blah blah. Go back, blah. And he was now. So what is going to be the benefit? If he has been so good to the Jews, good. This is better than good. You build your temple, that is beside the Moshiach. That's the thing, right?
Right.
Why? What's the benefit to him? There's got to be a benefit to
right.
his people.
Right, so I'm going to come back to that. Debbie suggests that maybe there is something in it for him. I want to come back to that idea. Before we get to the selfish aspects of it, or the self-interest at any rate, to put a nicer word on it. Well, I think the political element is actually not even selfish, but I think the political element goes back to something we pointed out last week. Remember that we said that one of the motivations for Tatnai in challenging the Jews' construction of the temple could well be because historically, if you take the historian's chronology of this period, this is a time when there are many other revolts going on from other populations. This period, 522 to 520, before the Common Era, we saw the quotes last week, indicates that there's a lot going on in terms of turmoil, and maybe the answer really is, Darius says to himself, I don't need more problems. I have enough problems in my kingdom, I don't need to deal with another Jewish revolt, so therefore, I'm going to bankroll their offerings. It'll make them happy, and at least keep peace in that part of my kingdom. So that could be, from a political side, that could be his benefit.
But they didn't even ask for that. They would have been very happy just to get extra from
Yeah, correct.
But then you got the Samaritans not happy.
Right. So the question is, what will be the downside to this? Will the Samaritans potentially be angry, and you lead to a Samaritan revolt? It's an interesting possibility.
Yeah, his general population is paying for something to the Jews.
Right. Unless he built them a park or two or something, or decreased the hydro rates, something along those lines. Another possibility is in Malbim. Take a look at source number one. Malbim seems to say, or seems to think, that there's an element of sort of family honor in this. He instructs, this is from Darius' instruction, Tiyu rechokin min habinyan hazeh. He instructs the locals, you should, you know, Tatnai and crew, you should stay away from this construction. Shalo tish bisu yedei osei hamalacha, that you should not halt those who are working. Achar, sheyeshla mershus alav min koresh, since they have permission to build from Cyrus. So notice the emphasis, they have permission from Cyrus, as in, you know, the first of this great dynasty. All of this comes from the initial part, comes from the original decree of Cyrus, before you get to all the parts that Darius added. So the fact that it's from Cyrus, even though he's adding to what Cyrus licensed, may also be a piece of this. But I think that it's true, and I'm going to show it as the Gemara's idea, that our classic way of looking at this kind of benevolence from someone who is not of our community is generally assumed to be selfish. It's generally assumed that he had some reason to do this for his own gain. And so for this, we're going to need to go through a couple of sections of Gemara from the volume called Rosh Hashanah. It has the potential to be confusing. Then I give you that preface so that it won't be confusing, like, because that's going to help, me having said that. If you take a look at source number 2, you see just the map of the 12 months on the Jewish calendar. The key thing you need to know in order for this Gemara to make sense is that the count of years and the count of months in the Jewish calendar are not synonymous. Meaning, in our civil calendar, it became 2017 on January 1, it will become 2018 on the next January 1, and so on every year. January is the first month, and the first day of the first month is New Year's Day. So you turn over the year on the same day that you turn over the month, the cycle of months, right? That's clear. But that's not always true. It isn't true in terms of our birthdays, right? If someone's birthday is April 20th, that's the day that they have a new age. That's when they become whatever they become next. They were 29. On April 20th, they become 30. Even though, when you count when they were born, right, when you say they were born in the year 1987, right, so you hit January 1, 2017. You don't say, well, now they're 30 years old. You wait until April 20th to say they're 30 years old. Their year doesn't turn over on the same date that the months turn over. You follow? The reason this matters is because this entire Gemara is going to hinge on the question of at what point the king is said to begin the next year of his reign. When does the king's new year begin? Let's say the king took the throne on, I'm just using the civil calendar. Let's say the king took the throne on August 1st. So on August 1st, 2015, the king took the throne. When does the king's second year begin? August 1st, 2016? Maybe.
No, 17.
No, the second year begins.
Oh.
Yeah. No, we have to keep with the same math. We just have to work with a different calendar. August 1st, 2016 could be, but recognize the havoc you're going to cause if you do that. Because remember that everyone dates their legal documents based on the year of the king. If with each king, you're going to start a new system of counting years. So with the old king, it was August 1st. The next king takes the throne on February 22nd. The next king takes the throne on November 1st. And people are working with these documents. These documents matter a great deal. For example, the date on a loan document, the date when a loan is originated, is the date when the lien begins on the lender's, on the borrower's property. So what happens if I now have a document that says that Reuven lent Shimon money on the on this month in the third year of the king, but I don't know when that third year actually began because each king starts the year in a different time. It creates chaos. So therefore, what the Talmud teaches is that we always started our new year for kings on the first day of Nisan. So what that means is, if you're looking at your calendar here, the 12 months of the year, if the king took the throne, let's say, on the first day of Sivan, the ninth month, the first year of the king would be Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Tevet, Shvat, Adar, and then the first day of Nisan will be year 2. Even though it hasn't been 12 months, doesn't make a difference. When you hit the first of Nisan, that's when the new year begins, and it doesn't matter whether he took the throne on the second day of Nisan last year, or whether he took the throne 2 weeks ago in the middle of Adar. You follow? So, if that were everything, this would be easy. The reason why it's not easy is because we actually had two different ways to do this. One way to do it was the first of Nisan. That's what we did for Jewish kings. However, for non-Jewish kings, it was the first day of Tishrei. Why is a really good question. But that's what we did. So if you had a legal document that counted from King David, King Solomon, King Saul, right? Any of those, then you're going to count from Nisan. If, however, it's from, we think, Cyrus, Artaxerxes, whatever, then it's going to be the first day of Tishrei that starts the new year. How's that for trouble? We thought we solved chaos, but we actually created more chaos. Because now we have two different systems running simultaneously.
Wouldn't you go by the Babylonian calendar? By the Jewish calendar?
Right, so apparently not. Bizarre, no? But true. Strange, but true. We worked with our own system, but we distinguished between our kings and their kings. Yes, the answer is it's strange, and that's what we have.
Do we know when they started their calendar? Would it have been the equivalent?
I don't know. It's a good question. I didn't look. Would they work by the individual king? Would they work based on the first day of a particular year, whatever it would be? It certainly wasn't going to be geared towards Nisan and Tishrei, per se. But they're working with lunar months also, so you know, you could
be those names, right. But it could be the same.
Right. No. So I don't know.
These
are Babylonian month names. But in terms of counting which one should be the first, that I don't know how they did it. So with all of that in mind, okay, well, the reason why all of this matters is going to be the question of how I view Persian kings who did nice things for us. If a Persian king allows you to come back and build your temple, if a Persian king says, not only could you go back and build your temple, but I'm going to fund your sacrifices, is he counted like a non-Jewish king? Or is he counted like a Jewish king? That's why this is going to matter. So take a look, please, at source number 3. And we're going to walk through this together. And we'll figure all of this out. It's based on verses in Haggai. You will recall that we already said that all the events of Haggai are credited to the second year of Darius. Right? That's supposed to be when the construction moves forward. So on that, source number 3. I'm going to break from standard practice and I'm just going to read through the English. I brought you the Hebrew also so that you can have it here. But in the interest of clarity, I'm going to stick with the English. Rav Yosef asked, I have a verse in Haggai, it's in chapter 1, sentence 15 in Haggai, that says, on the 24th of the 6th month, in the second year of Darius. Okay, now, whenever it numbers a month for us, it's always going to assume it's actually starting from Nisan. Even though I numbered them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 from Tishrei to Elul, because that's what we think of it. In general, it's actually starting from Nisan. So on the 24th day of the 6th month means the 24th day of Elul. Got it? That's what we're talking about. The 24th day of Elul in the second year of Darius. And then it says, later in Haggai, in the 7th, meaning the 7th month, meaning the month of Tishrei, the 21st of the month. And so the question is this. You're talking about King Darius. King Darius is not Jewish. If the previous event took place in Elul, and then the next event took place in Tishrei, it shouldn't be in the second year anymore. It should now be the third year. And the text should have said so. If his years changed in Tishrei, I added in the bracketed words, if his years changed in Tishrei, it should have been the 7th month in the third year. Now, parenthetically, this flies in the face of the Midrashim that you mentioned before, that Darius is the son of Esther and Achashverosh. Because if he really were the son of Esther and Achashverosh, he would be Jewish, and this wouldn't be a conversation. Unless you say Jewish king means king of Israel, that would maybe be an answer. But in any case, do you see what's bothering the text? The text is bothered because I have two verses regarding Cyrus. One verse describing an event in Elul. The next verse describing an event in Tishrei. And it doesn't... what did I say? Darius, thank you. The Talmud will also be confused with that, so it's not just me. You're right. One of them describing events in Elul, the next one describing events in Tishrei, and it doesn't say that the calendar changed to be year 3 for this king. But you told me that the years are supposed to change in Tishrei. That's the objection. Rabbi Avahu says, I can answer that problem. No problem. Cyrus was a kosher king, and so they counted for him as from Jewish kings. Don't worry about it. He was a kosher king.
What does kosher mean in this context?
I think it's a restaurant, not kosher king.
Does it mean clean? What does it mean?
What it means is he allowed us to come back and build the temple.
Oh, so
he's a good one.
Good.
Yes.
But we're talking about Darius.
So the Gemara is going to have two problems. Alina astutely mentions one of them, which is, you changed his name. Right? I thought we were dealing with Darius. Haggai thought we were dealing with Darius. So that's going to be one of our objections. So Rav Yosef challenges this idea first, though. Rav Yosef says, you're telling me that for Cyrus, we count from Nisan, right? Month 7, that like the Jewish kings. So Yosef challenged, and he says, not so fast. He says, first of all, then these verses contradict each other. I have other verses that are going to be problematic from the book of Ezra. And this house was completed on the 3rd of Adar, in the 6th year of King Darius. Okay, that's one verse, that the temple is going to be completed the 3rd of Adar, and it's named Adar, no numbers for this month apparently, it's the 3rd of Adar, in the 6th year, and we learned at that time next year, Ezra left Babylon with his exiles, that's coming up in chapter 7, and it says, and Ezra came to Babylon in the 5th month of the king's 7th year.
No, he came to Jerusalem, not Babylon.
You're right, the mistake in my translation, thank you. Came to Jerusalem in the 5th month of the king's 7th year. So he's arriving in the 5th month. The 5th month is Shvat, right? So now let's think this through. We can do this. The house is completed in Adar. The same time next year is a year later, which means that at this point you should be in the 7th year of Darius. That's when Ezra leaves Babylon. And they travel all the way until the 5th month, which is going to be Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av. They're going to arrive in the month of Av, which is after another Nisan has passed. So if you're telling me he's a good king and we count from Nisan, what year is this? This is like back in grade school. Oh no, math problems. The 8th year. I should have brought a calendar like you know, on the wall type of a thing. You've all been spoiled by the digital age. This happened right again. They finish building in Adar in year six. They start moving in Adar in year 7. They move for the next 5 months. It should now be Av of year 8. Because you told me the year changes in Nisan, because he's supposed to be a kosher king. So therefore, he says, I don't understand. If his year's changed in Nisan, this should have been the 8th year. Now, you're looking at this and thinking, wait, this says Darius, not Cyrus. Would you please make up your mind as to which Persian king you're talking about? Right? You started this whole discussion with Darius. Then you switched over to say Cyrus was a kosher king. Now you switched back to a verse involving Darius. So Rabbi Yosef says, also, how could you compare these people? One is Cyrus, the other one is Darius. So the Talmud says, oh, that's okay. Don't be bothered by the Cyrus and Darius thing. That we can tell. Yeah, I have friends who are twin brothers named Cyrus and Darius. Many years ago in university, Cyrus and Darius. So, it was taught, the Gemara's answer is a line which we quoted actually a ways back when we were trying to understand the chronology of the kings 3 or 4 weeks ago. We took it out of context then, because I thought I would be able to get away without having to give you all the backstory. I didn't realize I was going to have to do it anyway. But it was taught, Cyrus is Darius is Artaxasta. Apparently same person is what it sounds like we are saying. That's going to be our answer. Meaning, we call Darius Cyrus sometimes. Why? Because he was good like Cyrus. As it says here, we call him Cyrus because he was a kosher king. Artaxasta, because of his empire, meaning that was the title they gave to all the kings. That's the Paro of Persia, is Artaxasta. What was his name? Darius was his name. Now, there are two different views of this. When I brought this source a few weeks ago, I took it the way that Rashi and the Malbim seem to take it, which is that they're literally the same person. Meaning, when you see Cyrus and Darius, they're actually the same person. Whereas, Rashi commenting on the Gemara, as well as Tosfot, seem to take the view that it isn't saying they're the same person. There was a king, Cyrus. He lived, he did what he did. And then you have, later on, a king named Darius, who we also like to call Cyrus because he reminds us of the good Cyrus. He was kosher like Cyrus was.
But he was a Cyrus.
Exactly. He was a Cyrus small c. Correct. Exactly.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Exactly. You got it all. So, but the point is, that only solves the problem of why you're throwing Cyrus and Darius into the same conversation. You haven't fundamentally answered the problem. The problem that we're dealing with is still the same, which is, when you talked about Darius initially, you told me that his years changed in Nisan. He's a kosher king, like Cyrus, or he is Cyrus, but he's a kosher king. Then, on the other hand, when you actually talked about the completion of the temple and Ezra coming back to the land, the chronology was worked differently. His years changed in Tishrei. So what happened? Helen.
Does it work if you put him in beginning his year in Tishrei? Do the numbers work?
Yes, for this one, right. Not for the earlier one. Yeah. If you do it this one, yeah, absolutely. Because then what happened was, if you go back through it, you realize that the house was completed in Adar, in year 6. Then, a year later, in Adar, Ezra starts moving. That's Adar of year 7. And he arrives in the 5th month. That's Av, also still year 7. That works, because the year won't turn over until Tishrei. It'll work just fine. The problem is that before we were counting in from Nisan. So the answer is going to be something that really would give the accountants apoplexy. I don't know what. The answer is, Rabbi Yitzchak said, it's no problem. One is before he went bad. One is after he went bad. We liked him until we didn't like him, which is the way we work with our politicians in general. When everybody thinks they're going to be on our side, then, oh, they're great, they're fantastic. Then you find out what they're actually going to do. Oh, I can't wait to be rid of this guy. That's the way it works. So with Koresh, with Daryavish, with Darius, in the beginning of his reign, everybody loved him. He's great. We're ecstatic. And so let's count for him from Nisan. At some point, though, he went bad. And it went bad in our eyes, at any rate. And we said, he doesn't get the Nisan treatment. We're going to start counting for him from Tishrei. Can you imagine what this does to people's legal documents? The chaos this creates.
It's the whole purpose.
Yeah. I mean, now we're changing it midstream. This is a very dicey thing to do. There has to be an easier way to resolve these verses. But
Was he bad in? Do we read about his turning bad in Ezra?
So that's exactly what the next piece of Gemara does. We just finished the hard part. Everything we just did was the difficult passage. Okay, if you're not into calendars, just what you need to know out of what we did is that it seems like in the beginning of his reign, the verses in Haggai say that he is considered a good king in the sense that his years are calculated based on Nisan like Jewish kings. However, the verses in Ezra that talk about events later in his reign seem to have the years change in Tishrei as though he's not a Jewish king. And our resolution is he must have gone bad somewhere in that period of time. Between his third year and his seventh year, something went wrong.
His mom passed away.
That would be one explanation. The Gemara, though, doesn't focus on what made him go bad. The Gemara focuses on who in the world told you that Darius went bad. And this is where it's going to be relevant for our question about selfishness.
Can you say that Malcolm says it's the same person?
Malcolm seems to believe Cyrus and Darius are the same person. Yes. All along, one king.
Doesn't that contradict the first Malcolm that you brought?
That it was from the original decree of Cyrus? No, he'll say it's the same person. You're right. It does sound strange. In other words, why did they need to look it up if it was his own decree? But nonetheless, that seems to be his take.
But if he's not really Cyrus, he's just being called by the Jewish Cyrus because he was as good as Cyrus, then he did it.
Right, but Malbim and Ezra 4, we saw it a few weeks ago, really seem to believe they're the same person. So you're right. Then that makes this awfully
weird.
Then
he's also the king who stopped the building.
Then he's also the king who stopped the building.
That's when he had to change his name.
That may be a later event, but it depends on who you're working with. But yes. Right? Remember, that event is transplanted. Although Malbim doesn't think so. Malbim thinks it's the same one. Malbim will think it's all the same person. But let's see what the Gemara does to try to understand where it was that Darius went bad. We're going to see two out of the Gemara's three attempts. The third one is going to rely on a verse in Nehemiah. Maybe we'll come back to it when we get to that verse. But right now, we'll see the first two approaches. The Hebrew is on the bottom of the first side. The English is at the top of the second side. Maskifla Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana challenges and says, Umi Hechmitz. How in the world can you tell me that Darius went bad? Are you kidding me? He gave us all our karbanos. Right? Not only are you going to build it, but you're going to build it with all your local tax money, and it's going to provide your sacrifices. What Jewish king provided all of these things? Why are you calling him bad? Vaksiv, doesn't the verse say, Umachashkan, what's missing? And then he goes on to enumerate all of the different animals that they're going to bring as their offerings, and the wheat, and the salt, and the wine, and the oil, whatever the Kohanim in Jerusalem say to be brought daily, without fail. So, Amar lo Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak's answer is, Rebbe, my master of Kahana, mitunach, literally from your burden, from that which you brought, I will answer the question. Because the verse continues to say, dilahon mahakrav nichochin la'alaka shemaya, for them to bring offerings before the God of heaven, umatzlin l'chaye malka uvnohi, and to pray on behalf of the life of the king and his sons. In other words, as Debbie said, if they do something like this, it must be for a selfish reason. It was because he wanted us to pray for himself and for his children.
Okay, so there's the divine and there's the secular, both.
Yeah. The argument is that he does it because he wants to get something out of it. That's the first approach. To which the Gemara says, that doesn't make him a bad guy. I mean, we all do that.
Praying to God means that you're acknowledging that there is a God.
First of all, it means that he's acknowledging that there's a God, unless he's hedging his bets. Right, he's Pascal. Fundamentally, I mean, you say a mishaberach for somebody, right? And you give tzedakah. Like, what's wrong with this action, Helen?
I'm just saying that it's bad, and it seemed to me like this from the beginning when he said it won't come from our palace. It's going to come from your local area. That to me is bad. I'm not paying for it. You guys pay for it. Take it out of your area.
But otherwise,
that
money would have gone to you.
Right. It's a local
tax. The federal government isn't going to give us any monies towards hospital, school, blah, 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 whatever our provincial responsibilities are. We sort of expect the federal government to give it to us, some monies. And his father said, no. You take it. It's got to come from your
right. No,
that
right. It comes from your taxes. If otherwise,
taxes.
It would have gone
okay.
To the...
Right. No, it's the second point that Ari's making.
That, to me, is bad.
But that's because, right, the tax dollars were supposed to go federally. In other words, it's not that he's saying the money that you guys would have spent locally on your local needs now will go to your temple. He's saying the money that otherwise would have come to me in Babel I'm letting stay locally for the temple purposes.
Oh, right.
And that's my understanding of how it works. Okay. Because the same term is used for the taxes as was used by the Samaritans that we saw in chapter 4 when they said, you know, if they build their temple, they're not going to send you this tax anymore. So it's a tax that was anticipated as being for the federal government. So in terms of the this approach here in the Gemara, the Gemara asks the question, what's wrong with him saying, pray for me? What, doing that isn't good? Vatanya, we have an explicit brisa, a source that is contemporary with the Mishnah, the earliest work of Jewish law, written work of Jewish law. Ha'omer, somebody says, Sela zu litztaka b'shvil shayich yubanai. A person says, I'm giving this money to tztaka so that my children should live. U'bishvil she'ez geba l'chayei ha'olam haba. Or so that I should get life in the next world. Harei zeh tzadik gamur. He's fully righteous. Granted that we have our classic Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, right? Don't be like somebody who serves, like somebody who expects reward, right? Al tiyu kavadu amisham shemesarav almanas lekabel pras. Don't be like somebody who serves for the sake of reward. Yes, because that's an ideal. But you can't tell me he's a bad guy because he was hoping to get something out of his mitzvah. Yeah.
So we are trying to find evidence this is bad.
Yes.
For the sole purpose of making, of reconciling the fact that Darius and Cyrus are one and the same.
Not to reconcile that they're one and the same, but to, well.
And he's getting a good.
Right.
At this point, the evidence that he's a bad guy.
Right. So there are two different agendas involved here. Agenda number one is to reconcile the calendar. In other words, this is a scientific problem. Right? My problem is that my data doesn't work. I have data here indicating we count from here, data here indicating we count from there. I've come up with a hypothesis, and the hypothesis says maybe we switch systems in between, and the reason I would have switched systems is because he went bad in the middle, but in order to support that, you need some kind of evidence that he went bad, and that's what we're hunting for. That's agenda number one. But keep in mind what we did when we spent time learning Medrash here, right? 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, we spent the year looking at Medrash. And one of the things that we noted is that Medrash serves multiple purposes. Meaning, often in a Medrash, we learn Medrash on the beginning of Parshas Noach. A Medrash will be quoted on the beginning of Noach, but it was actually commenting on a verse in Iyov. Or somewhere else. It was a verse from elsewhere in Tanakh which was being explained, and by the way, it also explains this. And to my mind, the second agenda here is answering the question, as Debbie tried, of why did Darius do this? And the Medrash is really doing two things at once. It's reconciling our calendar problem, and simultaneously explaining Darius's motivation. Why did he do it? He did it because he wanted to make sure they would pray for him. So he set up their temple for them. That's the second line agenda in this. Sorry?
I said
this bothered
me.
Yeah, no, but that's what it is. So the Gemara that was bothered, it says that's not evidence of malfeasance. So the Gemara answers with a very interesting answer. Lo kasha, no problem. Kan be Israel, kan be Nochrim. It depends on whether it is a Jew or whether it is somebody else. And the idea here is explained by Rashi in source number 5. If you jump down to number 5, he says, Kan be Israel, shalibola shamayim. The heart of the Jew is for heaven. Ve'im marian alo bechayav, eino karelo tagar. If he's harmed during his lifetime, he doesn't complain. Right? No complaining whatsoever? Jews complaining? Never. I love Rashi's Jews. Ela tola hayisurin ba'avono. He assumes I must have done something wrong. If something if I've been good, right? Rashi wasn't here for you for the last 2 years. If I've been good, but something bad happens to me, I assume it must be that there was some flaw in my conduct, and that's what this is about. You got it. Aval nachri, but if you're dealing with a foreigner, im ein mativen lo kigmulo kare tagar. If he doesn't benefit, as he thinks he deserves, then he gets upset and says, hey, why didn't I get rewarded? The assumption is that the one who is not a member of the covenant doesn't have the same loyalty to the covenant. Similar idea. The Gemara in the beginning of Avodah Zarah, we talked about this, it's a lot of years ago, it's 5 or 6 years ago, and we learned Zechariah. If you remember, the end of Zechariah, it envisions a time of a great war on Yerushalayim, and that's the time when Mashiach comes, and then it says, after that, people are going to come annually to celebrate, and it's going to be the holiday of Sukkot. And based on that passage in Zechariah, as well as possibly a pasuk in Yeshaya, the Gemara says that in the future, the nations are going to come to God and say, you should give us a Torah too. We weren't as good as the Jews were, because we didn't get the Torah. Had you given us the Torah, we would have kept all the mitzvos as well. And at that point, God's going to say, okay, here's an easy mitzvah. It's called Sukkah. Go ahead. You've heard this Gemara before. They go ahead and build a sukkah. See how it goes. And so all of them are going to go up on their roofs and build sukkah, which in North America is a bad idea, but I guess in the Middle East it's probably safer. But they're going to go up on their roofs and build a sukkah, and then God's going to make it really hot. Right? Translation for Toronto, he's going to make it snow. But he's going to make it really hot. And they're going to get disgusted with this mitzvah. They're going to kick the door and leave. And the Gemara says, well, that's not fair. You make things difficult for them. We also leave the sukkah when it gets intolerable. Right? That's a rule. Mitzvah patur min ha-sukkah. If you're in pain, you leave the sukkah. You're exempt. To which the answer is, yeah, but they kick the door on the way out. Oh. It's the kicking of the door, saying I'm disgusted with it, that's where the flaw lies. So says the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. It's the same idea. The member of the covenant is somebody whose loyalty is to the covenant, not to themselves. And therefore, in the event that I don't get what I thought I was going to get, I'm not going to question, I'm not going to challenge, I'm going to say, well, there must be something that I didn't do right. I must not have lived up to my end in some sense. And the presumption is that the Nachri involved, in this case Darius, is only really doing it for the reward. He's not interested in doing it just because this is a good thing to do. He's not part of the covenant. And therefore, it's solely about the reward, and that's why this is considered to be inferior. That's the answer. However, the Gemara itself recognizes that this is not a great answer. And so it says, if you don't like that, I got another for you. Don't worry. Going back to source number 4. The Ibayis Ema. If you want, I'll give you a different answer. If you're in the Hebrew, it's the 6th line in the Hebrew. If you're in the English, it's where it says, or if you want. The Ibayis Ema. Menalan da'achmitz. How do we know he went bad? Literally, da'achmitz means that he became vinegar. He had been wine, and then he went sour. Or bitter. Vinegar, sour, or bitter? Sour. Okay. And bitter, thank you. Dichsiv. Because the verse says, we already saw this, was in Cyrus's initial decree, that they should build Nidbach and the Evan Galat Lasa, 3 layers of marble, and then a layer of wood, and it'll be paid for from the palace. So the Gemara asks, Lamalei da'avar hachi, why does he insist on having layers of wood built into the structure? Savar, he thought, Imardu bi Yehudai ikliye benura. He said, you know what? If the Jews rebel, I can burn down the building. That's why he wants wood in the building. Sorry, Debbie, what?
I was going to say that's how it's supposed to be done, but I see the next line.
Yes. How it's supposed to be done. Right, because we already did this last week, and we talked about the what this may have been about.
And we have building codes in Solomon.
So that's exactly what we're about to get to. You beat me to it. So the Gemara says this is how we know he went bad, because he retained the ability to burn down the building. It's a different sort of fire code, right? Instead of a fire code that's meant to keep it safe from burning, this is a fire code that's intended to guarantee burning. So the Gemara says, but wait, that doesn't work. Didn't King Solomon do the same exact thing? Vaksiv, the verse, actually says, and indeed, as was noted, I think it was Dr. Berger who said it. Yes, this is the Haftarah for Truma. I'm actually looking to see. It actually is right after the Haftarah for Truma. It's after the Haftarah ends. I was checking in here. Yeah, they have the Haftarah ending at the bottom of page 812 at verse 14. But in any case, in the construction of the temple, the first temple, it said, they built Shlosha Tue Gazit, three layers of hewn stone, Vitur Karesas Arazim, and one layer of cut wood, cut cedar. And indeed, we said last week when we read this, we said they're building it along the lines of what Solomon did, part of that legitimization of the second temple by modeling it on the first. To which the answer is, yeah, but Shlomo avad milamala v'iyu avad milamata. Shlomo put the wood way up out of reach. It wasn't, Shlomo did it because it would look nice, but he put it out of reach so that somebody can't burn it from the ground. Cyrus did it lower, Darius did it lower, or Cyrus initially did it lower down. Now, we have no evidence for this whatsoever. There is nothing in the construction in the first temple, there's nothing in the construction instructions given by Cyrus indicating upper or lower. But it's our assumption that if he went bad, it must be that he put it lower down, and that's where it would be different. Or, alternatively, Shlomo shak'e bivinyana, Shlomo embedded it within the structure. The wood was inset, so you couldn't reach it from the outside. Ihu lo shake bibinyana. He didn't do that. And once again, no evidence from the text, but we're trying to show that he went bad. Shlomo sadye besida. Shlomo lined it with lime. Ihu lo sadye besida. He did not line it with lime. That's your second attempt, and then the Gemara is going to give a third attempt, as I said, from a verse in Nehemiah.
What's the purpose of the lime?
The lime would, well, the general purpose of lime is it makes it look nice. It's a whitewash. But here it would shield it from being set on fire. Right? It's a mineral. It's chalk. Is what you're doing. Yeah, Laurie.
This is supposition as to why I went bad. Could there not be 75 other possible explanations?
Yes, but we would like to find some evidence to it from a verse. You're 100% right. It's entirely possible that the reason why the sages felt he had gone bad isn't recorded in anything we have. Entirely possible. The third source, when we get to it in the second chapter of Nehemiah, also isn't all that convincing, as you'll see. But fundamentally, why do we have this desire to explain Darius's actions by saying that he's selfish? So on one level, it's we're trying to resolve the calendar crisis. What happened in these verses? Why is it that Haggai seems to count one way and Ezra seems to count a different way? But I think on a greater level, I think there's really an inability to accept that this Persian king would have been so much greater than so many of our kings. I think we have a general cynicism about human leaders, right? Think of the verse in Psalms, in Tehillim, Al Tiftechu Bin Divim, don't trust princes. And the fact that also we didn't see him becoming helpful until this moment. If he really was such a wonderful guy, why did it take Tatanai writing away to the palace saying, where are the Jews' papers, to convert him into a lover of Israel?
Well, he was a busy king, a big empire.
Okay, he had revolts to deal with. Busy guy, it's true. Ralph?
Is this suggesting that the Second Temple was flawed in its construction deliberately?
Yes.
By Ezra?
Well, by order of the king. By order of... No, that's the suggestion, that this is royal order. That's what it's recorded as. Not that Ezra isn't even here. Ezra hasn't shown up yet. He's coming next chapter. Right? How far did it take us? We're in like week 16 and we still haven't seen hide or hair of Ezra. Well, possibly, depending on how you read the stories earlier. Ezra may be there just under another name. But yes, David.
Yeah, the question of why he acts favorably to the Jews. Wasn't it in very recent history that the Jews won a massive civil war in his empire and in his capital? They're a serious power.
Well, I wouldn't call it winning a massive war when you're able to defend yourself against people who are trying to kill you. I mean, you didn't take any territory, you didn't take any wealth, you survived.
Well, their leader became the prime minister of the country, and they killed...
Yeah. They killed the people who came to attack them. But you didn't gain territory, you didn't gain spoils. Mordechai's elevation was before that war. Mordecai's elevation is in the beginning of chapter 8. It's before the war. I don't see that as... I think it does bring him to everybody's attention. I just don't think that they're now a power. You know, and the text specifies that they're given the right to collect spoils, and they don't. So, you know, that to me is a sign of what they got and didn't get out of that day of battle.
But they chose not to.
Correct. Spoils. Correct.
But then again, still is the problem. Why did he have to wait for the letter? If he thinks there's such a big power and important, he would just say,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Why do we need to go hunting through Elam or through media to find the...
We're only seeing this story from the perspective of people very far away from Persia.
Right.
We don't know what his behavior was with the Jewish population in Persia.
Right.
At all.
No, we get no information.
And when asked to do something, he does it very quickly and beyond the norm.
Yeah. No, this is true. Okay.
Since it's stone in the wood, in the tunnel exhibition, when you go through the tunnels in Yerushalayim, I don't remember seeing low down. I mean, talking about Milmata, anything other than stone, 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 I don't remember seeing anything.
That's hard. That's Herod's.
No, the question is when Herod does his renovation, does anything remain from these walls?
No.
Not Shlomo, but from Ezra's wall. I don't know. Potentially, I would think. So I think we would need to ask the question of what exactly Herod did on the rebuild. So let's see a little bit of Ezra, of the book of Ezra. So we now have at least some approach to what might have been in it for Darius on different levels, whether it's a religious motivation, whether it's to put down revolt, whether it's because this is part of what the Achaemenid dynasty has established, whether it's because he wants them to pray for him, whether it's because this way he'll control the building and ensure that it'll be built in a way that it's vulnerable. All of these are potential explanations for what Darius was doing, but fundamentally, go back to the verses themselves and his order that he issues. He says, "Let the Jews build undisturbed." Right back in verse 7, chapter 6, verse 7, he says, "Shvuku la'avidas be'seilah kadeich." Right, leave this construction of the house of God. Right, hachas yudaya. We discussed last week whether this is. He's speaking of the pacha of the Jews, the leaders of the Jews. How you take that phrase? I'm not going to go back into that. But he says, let the Jews build on their land. Let the Jews build the temple in its place. He then gives the instruction about funding the expenditures. And here I wanted to show you something interesting. I brought it for you in source number 6 on the sheet. The Jews here are being provided with everything: the animal offerings, the grain offerings. You bet. So Mordechai Zer Kavod in the Dot Mikra edition of Ezra brings papyri from Elephantine, from later in the Persian period, end of the 5th century before the Common Era, so it's not that much later. Maybe you're talking a century later. In which the Jews of Elephantine in Egypt want to rebuild their temple. Meaning, there was a breakaway Beit HaMikdash, a breakaway temple in Elephantine, and the Jews brought offerings there. The locals were unhappy. That temple is destroyed. And the Jews then want to rebuild it and bring offerings there. So take a look here from the Center for Online Jewish Studies in this paragraph. The Elephantine papyri, which include letters, business contracts, and literary texts, document the daily life of a Jewish military colony in southern Egypt. The papyri written in Aramaic date to the 5th century BCE, when the Persian Empire dominated the ancient Near East. In this particular text, we learn a great deal about the relationships of the Jewish community in Elephantine, Yev in Aramaic, with their Egyptian neighbors and Persian rulers. The papyrus contains a letter from Yedanya ben Gemariah, the community's leader, to the Persian governor in Yehud, Judea. Yedanya requests permission to rebuild his community's temple, which had been destroyed by a group of Egyptian priests in league with the local Persian administrator. Amazingly, we discover in this letter that the Jewish community and temple had already been established at Elephantine long before the Persians established, I always get this wrong, is it hegemony or hegemony?
Hegemony.
Hegemony, thank you. Over Egypt, under Cambyses in 525 BCE. Even more confounding is the fact that the community had its own temple where sacrifices were offered to the Israelite deity. This raises significant questions about the nature of Jewish worship during this period, since it seems to be in opposition to biblical law. Right, we talked about this when we talked about the House of Chonio, which is later in history, still Second Temple period. The Torah bans sacrificial ritual at sites other than the one place where God chooses to establish his name. An ambiguous term that literally points to the mobile tabernacle, but surely includes the temple in Jerusalem, which was the religious capital at the time. In contrast, the Elephantine community offered the full range of animal sacrifices, grain offerings, and incense offerings at their temple. To complicate matters even further, we have a later document from the same archive which states that permission to rebuild the Elephantine temple had been granted by the religious authorities in Israel, along with permission to perform grain and incense offerings. Mention of animal sacrifice, however, is conspicuously absent. So what you see here is a little bit later, it's a couple of generations later, still within the Persian Empire, Jews wanting to build a temple, being licensed by the Persians to build the temple, being licensed to bring offerings, but not animal offerings. Now, the question is, why not? Why can't they bring animal offerings? What holds up the animal offerings? So here I brought you from source number 7, the Theological Dictionary of the Old Testament, not a Jewish work, but it's a respected work, and I found the idea also in other sources. Above all, the restriction of the offerings to mincha and incense, mincha is a flower offering, after the rebuilding of the temple, illustrates respect for the Egyptians and the cult of their god Chnum, meaning they have a ram god, and bringing animal sacrifices in the land of the ram god is generally indelicate. At the same time, from the perspective of Jerusalem, it was a good opportunity to restrict the sacrificial cult of Elephantine. If bloody sacrifice could no longer be offered, no one could speak of competition with the universal sacrificial cult of the Jerusalem sanctuary. It makes it very clear this isn't the Beit HaMikdash, this isn't a temple. Now, from the standpoint of traditional Jewish law, the temple in Elephantine is considered idolatrous. It's not considered to be a temple of God. It breaks the rules. It's not one of ours. I bring it for you more because it's an interesting example of how the Persians responded to the Jews constructing a temple. It's another case in which they attempt to do so. And we have literature surviving from it, not biblical literature. This is extra-biblical. This is from the papyrus that at Yev. Are you going to say something? No. Ralph, you were going to say?
At this time, there's no other ritual except sacrifice. They don't have prayer that we have.
Prayer already exists, going back to the first temple period.
Not ritual.
Not the prayers that we use, you know, today, in the structure with which we pray today.
This is the only way that they knew how to express their
Maybe for the Jews in Egypt, not for the Jews who would have been more mainstream. Meaning, we attribute the Amidah already to the Anshe Knesset Agdola beginning of the Second Temple period, and we're going to see, even within Ezra itself, Ezra more in Nehemiah, prayers and communal gatherings and Torah reading in the public and so on. I don't know what they're doing in Elephantine.
They're obviously doing what the Egyptians do, or trying to do what the Egyptians do.
That's certainly what it looks like. So we have more to see here. We're not done, but I think we'll call it at this point on this. We have to come back to this and see a little bit more yet about this. So I will wish you a Purim Sameach, and next week, God willing, we will wrap up hopefully chapter 6 and move into Ezra's arrival in the land.